Have you ever felt like you were living just a B or B plus life? It's so dangerous to live that, more dangerous than a B minus or a C plus life, because when you're living a B or B plus life, you don't change it. You think it's good enough. Is it? I'm Susie Welch. I host a podcast called Becoming You. People think, okay, an A plus life is not available to me, but there is a way. We are all in the process of becoming ourselves. Listen to Becoming You wherever you get your podcasts.
Folks, we are blessed with a lot of resources in the state of Louisiana, and we got to do everything that we can to protect those resources. And what we have experienced over the years is really a battle against imported seafood. And meanwhile, our own industry here has continued to suffer. And it's not because of a lack of effort. And certainly our guest, Jessica Domang, a state representative who's been at the forefront of this battle for a long time, joins us to talk about what they were able to accomplish this session. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Hey, Noel. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for your effort. Let's jump right in here and talk about some of the bills that you proposed and were able to pass through the session this year to protect our shrimping industry.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a package of bills that I worked with Commissioner Mike Strain on, you know, to help and support our seafood industry. And four of those bills were actually signed by the governor this week. And so that was very exciting. So HB 121 was the bill that gave the ag commissioner the ability to seize and destroy seafood that's in violation or mislabeled. And so that was a really big lift for us. Originally, we had LDH doing that, and LDH is still going to be able to do it. You know, they just need some help to be able to do that. And so having the commissioner to be able to do that is going to be really great. And you just want me to kind of go through all of them?
Yes, if you don't mind. I mean,
Yeah, absolutely. So HB 349 is the Seafood Safety Fund, which is going to give the commissioner a vehicle to be able to have funds to promote seafood, Louisiana seafood. HB 588 is adding members of the Seafood Safety Task Force. So we're adding members of that task force from the fin fisheries, the crabbers, and some other industries as well. And HB 725 requires that retailers and anyone who is selling seafood to retain their records for 6 months.
That bill, I really like the provisions of that bill, right? Because that way, government and regulatory authorities, they don't always move as fast as we'd like them to. And that's just kind of the nature of government, as you well know. I think that bill, House Bill 725, is going to go a long way. Your thoughts?
I absolutely think it will. And it goes hand in hand with some other pieces of legislation that were signed this year as well, because we've heard in the news and we've seen where restaurants or other entities were, you know, violated for or you know, sanctioned for serving seafood that they were labeling as Louisiana seafood, but it actually tested as imports. And so it may not be the restaurant's fault that's happening, because they're buying it from a distributor who's telling them it's Louisiana seafood. Now, we do know that there are some distributors that are commingling seafood, and that was another piece of legislation that was passed this year by Rep. Timmy Kerner. And so to go ahead and deal with the commingling of the seafood. And so it kind of gives us an ability to find the point of contact where that seafood is coming from, where that mislabeled seafood is coming from. And so, you know, once again, we're protecting the realtor, the restaurant owner. We're protecting the people at the dock, everyone, by this piece of legislation.
The commingling piece of legislation as well, I think, is huge. Yeah, I get the, I'm of the mindset now, Jessica, and I'm sure you're frustrated too. I think the punishment almost has to be really onerous now, right? To thwart
it absolutely does.
What these folks are doing. Am I off base or what?
No, you're absolutely on target. And I've spoken to Commissioner Strain as well. We were going to run a piece of legislation, but he said he didn't need to for him to be able to actually put on his website restaurants or realtors that are actually in violation of this. That way we as Louisiana residents can know what we're eating and where we're going and choose, you know, I'm going somewhere that only serves Louisiana seafood, or I'm going somewhere and I'm going to eat seafood that only comes out of the bayous of the Gulf of America. So we have that choice. And I think that, and I hate to say shame these places, but we have the ability to be able to do that. And I think, though, the harder we press, they're going to just stop selling it. They're going to say, you know, we're not selling that because it doesn't move. Like, it literally doesn't move. And the big box, the chains, they're always going to serve imports. But I'm talking about local establishments. We're seeing a lot more local establishments that are only serving Louisiana seafood.
Yeah, I mean, it just makes sense. You know, I mean, especially what I don't like are the ones that advertise it as Louisiana seafood and it's not. You know, and I think,
correct.
You know, because they're actually misleading. There's intentionality there, and they're misleading the public. And therefore, in my view, they should lose their occupational license. They should lose, you know, their sales tax permit. They should lose all of that, because I think that's the only way that you send the message across the industry. We're going to set the bar, and we're not willing to accept anything less.
Absolutely, and we. Over the last few years, we've had several pieces move. And so it is good, and it's reassuring to see. I mean, I know I'm seeing it in my own town. And when we go out, a lot of places are only serving Louisiana seafood.
In a NOLA.com article the other day, Josie Abagov, I guess, was the writer, the author. She mentions that 95, I mean, this blew me away, that 95% of the seafood consumed in the U.S. is imported from other countries. I mean, I was completely shocked.
Yeah, that's shocking as well. That's absolutely shocking as well. But you also have to think of, like, you know, sushi grade tuna and all those restaurants, like you go eat sushi, or all that is all imported. And so, I mean, that's not something that we can necessarily produce here in the United States. So when we have those numbers like that, we have to kind of look at all of those different avenues and those different, you know, things that people like to eat. And look, I love sushi, but we also don't necessarily ask where the sushi is coming from.
Yeah, I just kind of, you know, when I think about, you know, crabs and shrimp and, you know, we have a lobster industry. We have an oyster industry throughout the country. I was like, when I was just kind of going through it in my head, I was like, it would seem to me that we would have more market penetration than that, but I guess not. And I guess that goes to the dominance of the imports, and also goes to the difficulty as you try to address this in legislation to try to turn the tide.
Absolutely, and it's a team effort on the state and the federal level, and there's been several pieces that were pieces of legislation that were filed actually this year to combat imports and imported seafood on a federal level, because of course, you know, we can't control what's imported into the United States on a state level. That's all federal, and so there has been a movement. I know. Some of our congressmen here in Louisiana have worked on some of that legislation as well. You know, we're planning on going to D.C. as well and to advocate for the seafood industry. And so, once again, it's a team effort on the state and the federal level.
What has been the receptiveness at the federal level? I think you're moving on this American Seafood Competitiveness Act. And I guess, is that the one where there are the provisions as it relates to the breadth and depth of testing these products?
Yes, that was that. And I haven't, because, you know, literally we just got out of the legislative session 2 days ago. I haven't had...
Wait a minute, you're taking time off? Really?
Yeah. So I haven't had time to really follow some of those pieces, but I will be. But just, you know, I know Clay Higgins has filed some legislation. I know Julia Letlow has filed some legislation. So it's definitely getting a lot of attention from our local federal leaders.
How, when we look at like the Gulf Coast states, I mean, are like Texas and Alabama and Florida as proactive as we are in trying to address this situation?
I would certainly hope that they are. I would absolutely hope that they are. And, you know, once again, I'm happy to work with those guys. I'm actually taking a trip to meet with the Natural Resources Committee in Texas in August. And so that will be part of my conversation is, you know, where are you guys at on imported seafood and what is it that you guys are doing over there as well?
Because when you face this issue of 95%, you know, of the consumption in the U.S. being imported, I mean, it really kind of highlights and put in context that this is bigger than Louisiana. It's going to take a coalition of a lot of states coming together on this issue, right?
Absolutely. Look, and you know, you hear what President Trump says all the time. He wants it to be America first, right? And so so we have to say, you know, America first seafood as well.
Let's, I know that you have very close ties to the shrimp industry here in Louisiana. Brown shrimp season, I believe, is still open, if my memory serves me correct. What kind of season has it been, do you know?
It seems like it's been a pretty good season. I actually went and got an ice chest of shrimp on this past weekend and brought it to one of my legislative friends in Baton Rouge so that he could take it home. And so, yeah, our shrimpers are doing real good. They're catching a lot now. Look, the price of diesel is killing them, though. You know, I mean, so
right.
That's something that we've got to, you know, outweigh as well. And once again, that's not something that we can control on a state level. But that's really tough whenever you've got a low price of shrimp and you've got these high diesel costs. It really hurts these guys.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how tight the margins are. I'm always just kind of blown away by that.
Absolutely. Look, and if anybody wants to come down to Terrebonne Parish and come down the bayou, I mean, there's shrimpers that are at the docks. You can buy at the docks. You can buy off the boats. It's a great drive down. Come see our beautiful parish. But, you know, our shrimpers would absolutely appreciate, you know, everyone going in and buying directly from them.
Well, I will not keep you any longer, Jessica, so you can get back to rest and relaxation as you just ended the session. But we certainly appreciate you joining us today, this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. That's Jessica Domang, state representative from Terrebonne Parish, about protecting our shrimping and seafood industry, not just the shrimping industry. A lot of success with some of the legislation this year, which is good to hear. We'll be right back. And when we come back, folks, we will go to the talk lines. We want to hear from you, 504-260-1870. We can talk about anything that you desire. Stay with us.
How We Met Your Mother is the How I Met Your Mother Rewatch podcast with me, Josh Radner, and series co-creator Craig Thomas. Follow How We Met Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. Give us a call, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. We can talk about anything that you desire. Let's go to Mike. Mike, you're up. What say you?
Hey, Newell. Thank you so much for taking my call. Always enjoy listening to you. I work from home, so I get to listen to your entire show. Just for the last caller, I, you know, one thing I think that needs some accountability or some attention needs to be brought to. I was with the department, LDWF, for about 7 years, and we spent millions of dollars from the BP oil spill, millions of dollars on the seafood, Louisiana Wild Seafood Certification Program, on an educational program, Louisiana Fisheries Forward, and on a sustainability program. And what I find, which is unfortunate with state government, this happens all too often. Millions of dollars are spent on these programs, and then they just fall to the wayside, or they let an NGO pick these programs up and run with these programs. And I just don't understand. I've never really understood the disconnect. You know, I'm back in the private sector, and when I think about what I witnessed when I worked for state government, the lack of accountability, the lack of follow-through, because the tools are in place, the money's been spent, and I just don't understand it. And so just listening to that last caller, it just struck a nerve with me. There are good programs in place. There's money that's been spent. There's groundwork that's been laid. But I just feel that this happens a lot. And I don't think it's just specific with one department. I think it's specific with state government. It happens a lot. No money is spent. Things are put in place. And then it just, because of political reasons or change in governors or change in secretaries of agencies, it just falls to the wayside.
Well, it's probably a little bit of all of that, plus the manner in which we're financing it. I know that you're totally aware of these grant programs, right? And
yes.
I'm sure you saw them. And they're time sensitive. So there's a period of time that you get this money. Sometimes it's a year, 2 years, 3 years. I never liked taking grant dollars for an activity that I wasn't willing to invest in it myself in order to keep it going. I never really liked getting in and then getting out because the funding went away and I wasn't able to continue that program going forward. And I think that's where a lot of this emanates from, that you're talking about this culture that we've developed. I call it this beggar mentality, right? Where we go out there and we're doing great at getting these grants, but we're not really implementing them operationally, thinking about longevity, which is exactly what you're complaining about, because they're worthy, right? But their worthiness
Absolutely.
Is diminished if they go away after a short period of time. I mean, it's like we went through this exercise. We developed this infrastructure. We may have put some software in place and on and on. And then all of a sudden, it just goes away. It's like, well, wait a minute.
Yeah, I mean, we did some extensive work. This was under Secretary Barham at the time. And I think our initially, Jindal was the governor, then John Bel Edwards became the governor. And this was about 7 years. And I mean, we worked to the bone to put these programs in place. And then all of a sudden, you know, a change in guard takes place. And what you hear is, well, the department should just manage the resource. We shouldn't manage things like marketing or promotion of Louisiana seafood. Well, wait a minute. And so it's almost as if, Newell, this is what I experienced in my 7 years of working for state government. You get this money, we're just going to spend it. Like, there's no method to the madness, but then we're not going to sustain it. And that's what's so upsetting, because our seafood is the crown jewel. There is no question about that. Everywhere you go in this country, people know and recognize our seafood. They want our seafood. It is our most precious natural resource. And I feel like it never gets the true attention, the true care that it deserves. We should care about this more than anything in terms of our natural resources that we produce here in the state of Louisiana. And it's just, it's upsetting to me. I'm happy to hear the last caller, but again, where is the accountability? Where's the checks and balances? Newell, have always said this. If I would have had the accountability that I have in the private sector with what I do with state government, boy, we would have been in trouble with state government. A whole lot of heads would have rolled.
that's part of the frustrating part. I mean, you know, when you think about, you know, like just preventive maintenance, right? In the private sector, you see a whole infrastructure about that because it has value. It appears on their financials, right? All of that has value. You want to take care of it, care and custody of the of this asset. In government, it's meaningless. And that's why, you know, I was reading an article this morning about the sewage and water board pump stations. The bells, the discharge bells, those big pipes that are going in the ground, they're all rusting away. And it's like no one's looked at it since like 20 years ago. It's like, what?
And I think that's why I love listening to you, your common sense approach. And I just, you know, Newell, I'm going to leave you with this interesting thing that occurred. When I first put the program together, the vendor, the NGO, I wanted them to do a quarterly report. So four times a year, we're giving them millions of dollars. And I'm called in and I'm told, boy, you're going to really tick them off. I said, excuse me? We're giving them millions of dollars. I want to see deliverables. I want to see progress. I want to see tangible results. It's almost as if that's not understood at that level. No, just give them the money. And all is good.
I'm glad you brought that up because this is a topic that I was going to talk about in this period of time. And I don't know if you're aware of this. The Treasury Department recently made an announcement that the IRS would be proposing revisions to the Form 990. And you probably know that these NGOs, most of them are not-for-profits. And this is the actual IRS return that they have to file, that they're compelled to file with the IRS. But it's really kind of loosey-goosey. It doesn't ask a lot. It's very general. So you don't know a whole lot. You don't learn a whole lot about the not-for-profit as a result of that 990 filing. Now, what always rubbed me the wrong way is that some of these NGOs, 100% of their money comes from the federal government, comes from state government, sometimes comes from local government. And yet, there's very little that they have to account for in their 990 filing with the IRS, like related party transactions. How many of their family members are on the payroll? You know, they give... you have to give like the CEO's salary and some other key individuals in the organization, but it doesn't go much further. You don't get a breakdown of where the money's coming from, where the money's going to. And it seems as though there's going to be a move afoot by the Treasury, and I applaud them for this because the NGO not-for-profit abuse, and look, there's some great not-for-profits that are out there, and we're very fortunate in the city that we have some wonderful not-for-profits here, but we have some that are taking advantage of taxpayers, taking advantage of donors, taking advantage of a lot of folks that don't know any better. And when you go to like GuideStar.com or other places to kind of look at these 990s, or you can go to the IRS website and look at these 990s, there's little information that's given, but yet they're completely, totally funded by taxpayers. And now you have other organizations that are doing related party relationships that they're developing, like joint ventures, to use that 501c3 organization for their purposes. You don't get any reporting on that. And you find out that the 501c3 that you're giving money to is actually off and running with these other organizations that are never reported on. All of that needs to get hammered down. They need to report on that, and the public needs to know exactly who it is that they're dealing with, because this situation is kind of run amok, and it kind of dovetails into what some of your frustration is as well, Mike. Go ahead.
We've got about another minute. Newell, I can remember there were fee-for-service contracts and then cost-reimbursable contracts. And right before I exited, my vendor NGO pounded me because they didn't want a cost reimbursable, because that means we cleaned a toilet, we have to report, like, you know, let's say it's a janitorial contract. We cleaned a toilet, we've got to report that. We just want the money. We want the fee for service. Just give us the money, and then we promise to do the work. And that's the problem. There were so many professional development or professional contracts where these people were supposed to be providing services, and they never did. And we would just write the check. We would write the check.
Yeah.
We would write the check. And this is our citizens' dollars. That's the bottom line.
No doubt. Frustrated. No. Fraud and abuse throughout the system, for sure. Mike, thank you so much for the call. Got to get to a break. Have a great week. 504-260-1870. When we come back after the break, we'll go to the talk lines. We want to hear from you. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, folks. Love to hear from you. 504-260-1870. Breaking news. The governor said that he will sign the bill to eliminate three judges of the criminal district court. And we'll probably talk more about that tomorrow and what that actually means to the criminal justice system in the city of New Orleans. You will recall that the bill was amended because they were going to deploy the LIFO, last in, first out approach. Those with the least amount of seniority would be, those positions would be eliminated. That was changed. Senator Jay Morris, who was the author of the bill, in conference agreed to substitute Rhonda Douglas Good. I think I got her last name right. Excuse me. And who had more seniority than someone else. I don't know. Again, I don't know why we always have to complicate things. I mean, you know, we were protecting someone, somewhere, somehow. How that name got pulled out of the hat seems pretty arbitrary to me. And again, we've just made it more difficult than it needs to be. It's already a difficult topic, and then you convolute it even further. But here we are. I mean, you heard me rant about that in my monologue this morning. I don't know if any of y'all got to listen to Tommy Tucker's interview with the gentleman who was talking about the value of college education today, and the differences between university, and whether or not there are marked differences, whether or not there are value-based differences. Great interview. Go back to Odyssey.com and listen to it, especially if you have kids in high school and headed towards college, thinking about it. You will also recall that during the pandemic, we had this move where we were kind of just throwing meritocracy right out of the window, right? It was like testing bad. We just want to be subjective. We don't really want any objective measures to convolute our application as we consider who's going to get in and who's not. Well, thankfully, that's changing in the world today. And standardized tests like the SAT and the ACT, they're coming back. And, you know, for a long time, and there's a Wall Street Journal article that was posted this morning. Douglas Belkin is the author, if you want to check it out. According to FAIR Test, 90% of colleges right now, today, don't require the SAT or the ACT. Now, a lot of students still take one or both of those tests, and they submit their scores to admissions offices. And a lot of these admissions offices, although they don't require it, they actually take that into consideration. But what's happening is that high school students, according to the article, are having a real difficult time meeting the SAT's math and reading benchmarks. In fact, fewer than 40% of the test takers actually met the benchmarks, which is, the benchmark is designed to predict whether someone has a 75% chance of getting at least a C in a first semester college level math, writing, or history course. Let me repeat that. The benchmark is that you have a 0.75% chance, 75% chance of getting at least a C in a first semester college level math, writing, or history course. And fewer than 40% of the test takers are actually meeting that benchmark. Those that are advocating for these tests to come back, ACT, SAT, are doing so because of grade inflation. We've heard a lot, we've seen a lot of stories about this, and that GPAs are really kind of almost of no value any longer in their ability to predict how an applicant is going to do and the quality of their work in colleges. And that's why you have universities like MIT, Dartmouth, University of California, hundreds of professors are urging the UC system to reinstate entrance exam requirements. Why? Because their experience with freshmen that are coming in, they can't cut it. They can't pass the classes. They're feeling like their time is wasted, right? And that they're not clued in. And when you talk about borrowing the amount of money that families are borrowing today and the debt that they find themselves in with some of these universities that are charging $80,000, $90,000 a year in tuition, you begin to wonder, the quality of the students that you're entering these supposedly high performing schools, where only 10% of colleges today are actually requiring the ACT or the SAT. It's kind of interesting how we got to this place where we no longer want to set high standards for people to meet, right? Everybody gets a trophy. Everybody gets to go to MIT, or everybody gets to go to Harvard. Everybody gets to go anywhere they want, without ever having to prove themselves. And we always end up in this fairness argument. Well, you know what? Life's just not fair. Never has been, never will be. You will always have the haves and the have-nots. You will have those that succeed and those that don't. You will have those that put in a lot of effort, those that are lazy. You have people that will be on time and those that won't. You will have people that are courteous and those that are not. I don't know where we think we're going with some of this, but it's not going to change any of that. So hopefully more and more of these colleges go back to these tests, which is an objective measure. Is it perfect? No, there's no perfect objective measure. And, it's amazing. We want to throw everything out because, well, it's not perfect. Well, no. I mean, I don't know any perfect people. I don't know any perfect systems. I really don't know of anything that's perfect, quite frankly. I guess in some realm you can say that, mathematical equations are perfect. But other than that, I don't know of any. But yet we find ourselves where we're willing to throw everything out for the sake of not having, you know, perfection and not being perfect in its outcome. And I think we're less than if we continue to go down that path. Got to get to a break. 504-260-1870. When we come back, we'll check in with Scoot to see what he has coming your way. When we return, stay with us. Welcome back, folks. You will recall we were talking several months ago about the Gust high-rise Gust homes where the resident management corporation had difficulty in paying their water bills. And it was a big issue. HUD comes in, the housing authority comes in, and they look at it. They can't figure out who's on first, what's on second. Well, thankfully, this past Thursday, Hano announced that it would assume direct management responsibility for the Gust High Rise and its three townhome developments as part of its plan, because the vacancy rates were going up and they couldn't finance this any longer, and maintenance wasn't being done. It was being deferred. And it was a mess. No one could get a straight story out of the director. It was nothing but a word salad. And it became blatantly obvious that something had to change. Well, thankfully, it did. And, you know, they were $1.5 million past due on a water bill. Who knows what else was being deferred? And who else, you know, knows what was actually going on there. So it's good news that the Gust Homes will be taken over by Hano, and hopefully they are able to straighten some of those issues out, because how do you get, you know, it's again with the back to the sewage and water board, how do you let somebody get $1.5 million in arrears on water bills? How does that happen? You know, but it's an example that we're not running this like a business at all. And we're not highlighting these challenges like we should be highlighting them, because and this is why, you know, we have difficulty in delivering potable water day in and day out in the sewage and water board, because we're not minding the P's and Q's of what it takes to run a business. And that's what it is, a business. All right, Scoot's coming up next. I don't know. Has he joined us, Coleman? All right. So Scoot's getting set up there, and he's going to be right with us and be able to tell us what he has coming your way. Hope you enjoyed today's show. We covered a lot of territory, a lot of different topics. Talked about some things in my monologue as well. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Yeah, sorry I'm a few minutes late getting into the studio here. So we've got a lot to talk about. This is, let's see, I saw the movie, not the movie, I saw the play Spamalot, Monty Python, last night at the Sanger. And mm-hmm. I never got into Monty Python before, but I really got into the play. It was really good. We'll talk about that. Scott Pelley fired from CBS, that's big. And another battle for freedom of speech, all of that coming up.
All right, Scoot's headed your way. Have a great Wednesday evening. We'll see you in the morning.
Life can feel overwhelming, but on my podcast, From the Heart with Rachel Brayton, we're in it together. Every Friday, a new episode brings you a new story with topics on motherhood, wellness, self-love, and more. Listen to From the Heart with Rachel Brayton wherever you get your podcasts.